lately, I found myself asking a question over and over again. And it goes something like this. How is it that one stands firm by his or her own convictions and yet creates space for people who do not share those same convictions? I don't think I'm the only person asking this question. It seems to come up in other conversations I have with people, podcasts I listen to, because it's in the zeitgeist. We have become this kind of culture that doesn't know how to hear and listen to and appreciate difference. And it's not like it's come out of the blue. It's probably worsened the last 2 years, but it's been coming on for decades. And you can make a good argument that it's partisan politics. You can probably make a good argument that it's about class or educational attainment, about rural-urban divides, about age, even about how we understand the decline of white Protestant values. All of these things contribute to our seeming inability to be able to talk to one another. But we all agree it's a problem. And we're not sure exactly how to solve it. Taking what was past and moving it into the present isn't really a viable solution. Time just simply doesn't flow in that direction. And trying to silence voices of people just generates anger, and that usually begets violence. And so for a variety of reasons, I think as a society, we're kind of asking ourselves how we move forward. How do we move from this place? And the more I think about it, the more I'm convinced, my own conviction here, that the church is the organization best poised to model what this looks like. Model how it is that we're in relationship with people who are really, really different than us, and yet not be enemies, be friends. And so that's why this passage today from the lectionary, from Paul's letter to the Romans, just sort of leapt up at me. It was not really what I was looking for. I was looking for a sermon on Exodus, but that's a whole other story to tell another day, another time. So this passage from Romans is so relevant because Paul is writing to a church of like extremely diverse people. Rome had conquered all these lands. They brought slaves from every direction. And so the people who find themselves in the church in Rome are of diverse backgrounds. They've come to faith from a variety of experiences that are not consistent with each other. And so they've arrived at different conclusions about what their faith means. And so the issues they seem to be arguing about are like, should Christians be vegetarians? Or can we be carnivorous? Are some days more holy? Or are all the days kind of the same? And you can think that that's foolish, but there's nothing silly about it. Because those issues had the power to divide that church, just like issues we know, like, I don't know, women's ordination or gay marriage or changing patterns in worship, have the power to divide us today. And so Paul is keenly aware of the power these issues have and keenly committed to making sure that this church doesn't slice itself to death over them. So he writes this letter. And he understands immediately that both the carnivores and the vegetarians are firmly convicted about the place that they stand. They have thought about their position. They have reasoned it out through faith and through prayer. They think it accords with Scripture. And so browbeating by anybody is going to get nobody any place. It just ends up a zero-sum game where everybody's just bruised. And so Paul decides that there is a better middle way. Paul has opinions about this question too. You can read between the lines what they are. You can read other books he writes where he talks about some of these same questions. But Paul, for all his ego and all that he thinks he's right all the time, also sets aside his opinion. And so he invites everybody into kind of a third way of engaging. And it doesn't look like not talking. It looks like better listening and ensuring that everyone gets a space at the table, that the engagement is sort of a place of respect for all people. He doesn't want them to stop talking about it. He wants them to find new respect for their brothers and sisters in the faith, that they've all arrived at these convictions from a place of deep thought. And when you try to act like your position is the only one that's correct, you're suddenly acting as if you're the master of another person. And Paul says, that's not true. None of you are the master of anybody else. All of you are servants of Jesus Christ. So however you arrived at your position to eat meat or not, that's about how you are trying to be a good servant of Jesus Christ. Paul says, nobody here answers to anybody else. at the end of the day, you're all going to answer to Jesus. And that's the foundation of his argument, really. It's this, that you stand before Jesus Christ because of grace. His argument is one through and through about grace and grace alone. That the Romans may think that their convictions about meat or holy days are really important, that they pertain to everyone's salvation, and Paul just says, actually, no. They might be important to you. It's good that you're trying to figure out how to follow Jesus, but your salvation is only about the grace of Jesus Christ. You stand in grace. And that's about the prior decision God made before you even came along to love you, to die for you, to rise for you. And when you realize that all of us, all the Romans, even us, are all equally in need of grace, it begins to change how you see your neighbor. Your convictions don't stand you in better stead with God. We're all equal before a cross, before a grave, before a resurrection. And when we understand that, it changes because it's humility giving. You begin to realize your neighbor stands directly next to you, that we're all in the same boat. We all need Jesus. We all need grace. And that's the foundation on which all of us can stand. And so the question of our convictions then is a secondary issue. And Paul wants to first ground everybody in grace and have it shape their hearts and minds so they're ready to compassionately interact with each other. When they realize that God, in God's great mercy, created space for each of them, they realize it's their job to make space for each other. But Paul isn't arguing for some kind of fake peace. He's not asking them to paper over their differences or never talk about them because it's difficult. Instead, he's inviting them to continue talking about it, but to let all the prejudgment go. He says that right in the middle of the passage. Just stop judging the heck out of each other. Stop attributing false motives to the people who don't agree with you. And just hold some space for them. He's inviting them to change how they speak and to change how they listen. That they speak with respect and honesty, their truth, but that they listen with honesty to the other person, opening their heart. Because see, when we're willing to create that kind of space, based in a kind of mutual honesty and a pursuit of truth, it creates a space in which we can really share, in which we can trust one another. And even if the Romans have this debate and they walk out the door of their meeting disagreeing about meat and vegetables, they walk out the meeting having more respect for their neighbor who has the different opinion. They walk out that door having a new kind of trust in one another, that even if they don't have an answer, they don't have a middle way, they leave having some things to think about. They leave with a humanized understanding of a person who has a different opinion. And from that place, you know, it's a place to move the world. You from that point, you have leverage. You can begin to work together in better ways because you're fostering an understanding. And so I think, looking at Paul's advice to the Roman church, we can come back to what is my original question, perhaps yours, of how we do this thing, how we stand for what it is we believe in, without capitulating, but create space for other people to say what they believe in without making them feel dehumanized. And it seems to me it begins with this kind of radical honesty piece. That when we come to the table to talk to one another, we come as we are with an openness and an honesty to share what's true. That when we come, we're ready to find and share the courage of our own convictions, that we tell the truth about it. Because if we don't, then we're not contributing to the process of healing. If we come and we're rude to other people, or we lord it over them, or our argument is in violent kinds of language, we close doors, we don't open them. Likewise, if we come to the table and pretend like we agree with everything, or we just don't share what's true for us, and then we leave, and we feel like no one understands me, and I don't get my way, or, you know, become sort of aggressive underneath, that's not helpful either. Because by remaining silent, we don't offer growth to anybody. And it bubbles up inside of us in anger and bitterness, rage. And so we have to be willing to actually share what's true. But sharing goes with listening. And we have to listen with honesty also. That so often we're not taught how to listen, we're taught how to talk a lot. We're not taught how to listen. And so we start to listen to someone we disagree with and we begin shaping our own next argument. We come up with all the facts that combat their facts, and we think they're all self-evident. Or we begin to sort of shake our head violently because we disagree so much we can't let them go on. Or we just disconnect. We don't want to hear what they have to say, so we just shut off our heart from what it is. And Paul says, no, you're going to share honestly and you're going to listen honestly. You're going to open your heart to the other person. Not that you have to agree with them, but you can at least hear them, offering them the most basic human dignity of honoring their person, of honoring their thoughts, of honoring their ideas. And I think when we open our hearts to one another, when we share what's honestly our conviction, and we listen to what's honestly another person's conviction, something happens in that space. Because now we trust each other in a new way. Now we at least understand the other person's framework. We can't attribute to them false motives. We can't demonize them. They're not some great other. They're now a neighbor who has shared their thoughts and their feelings, and we have heard that. And maybe that moves us to that point of leverage again, a new place for how we can move forward. Or maybe it just leaves us with something to chew on. Maybe it just leaves us with a better understanding of who our neighbor is and what they're wrestling with. Maybe it's not all that different from what we're wrestling with. But the thing is, if we just talk and listen, I know that can sound like a recipe for stagnation. But in our world, the gospel is always on the move. It's not as if God halts. And when we listen to one another, there's always another party involved, the third person of the Trinity, God the Holy Spirit. So when we're talking and listening to one another, we're also listening for where it is that the truth of God is speaking. Where is love moving? What is the movement of grace in our convictions? And if my conviction isn't aligning with that, I really have a lot to think about. There's a story, and the roots are true, but there's some apocryphal elements perhaps to it, about Martin Luther being called to account for his ideas to King Charles V. And Charles is kind of pissed off because I shouldn't have said that. He's angry. Charles is angry because Martin Luther is enacting a reformation. And everybody is, you know, at each other's throats. And Charles says, why are you doing this? And Martin Luther models what I think is also as good as what Paul models. And he starts from a place of confession because he's just going to share what's true for him. And he says something along the lines of, I know. And Martin Luther never meant to tear apart the church. He had great humility and a great kind of like soul struggle about it. But what he says is, I have read the gospel in Greek, and I see now how God's love is expanding, how it's about the grace of Jesus Christ. It's about faith. It's about the righteousness of Christ, not my righteousness. And Martin Luther says, I have come to this place, and I think it is the truest thing I've ever heard. And he says, here I stand, I can do no other. And whether he said that or not, the sentiment holds. That he comes into that place and he could have said, okay, you're right, it's controversial, I'll stop talking about it. But he realizes that what he's discovered is something that is expanding the movement of grace, that love is flowing forward, and he doesn't want to dam it up again. He doesn't want to stand in the way of it. And so what he offers isn't a browbeating argument, not accusations. He doesn't tell Charles V all the things the church has done wrong. He just says the truth that he knows. He names it. He stands by it. He doesn't really back down, but he offers the chance for openness. And he certainly doesn't stand in the way of grace. And of course, hindsight's 20/20, we know that the movement of grace expanded out a great deal from what Luther did. But I think, together with Paul, they provide us a model that moves us beyond angry accusations and arguments that are just about sort of beating people up and about not sharing what's really true and then being angry about it later. That we have to be able to create spaces in which we perhaps confessionally share what's true about ourselves and hear what's true about other people. And I think if the church can't do that, who can? And I think we have to practice like we want to play, right? You can't show up at a match and never having served a tennis ball. Likewise, we can't show up in the world and try to broker conversations of peace if we haven't practiced here. And so I hope that this is a place where we experiment with that. Where when we disagree with one another, we don't just pretend like, I completely agree with you, let's paper over that problem and never talk about it again. Where instead, we generously listen and we generously hear. And we listen for the Spirit, too, to move us towards grace. We're always asked to move in the direction of grace, to go with that, to stand for love. We owe everybody human dignity and respect. We owe everybody the right to be heard. And so, with that in mind, some of our programming is going to be moving in kind of directions that allow us to practice and engage that. If you were at Tap Into Faith in Thursday, you know we've already started. But it was difficult. We had a conversation about racism, a conversation no one wants to talk about, but which is at the heart of a lot of American controversies. And I thought it went well. I think despite nerves, despite me sweating through like the clothes I had on, and then being like giddy when it was over that no one, you know, but we had a really constructive and good conversation, and people did not agree. It was good, and it was right. And so I hope that when we talk to one another, when we have coffee hour, when we do Tap Into Faith, when we do things, or you have comments to make about liturgical things, or I think we just need to practice this so we can be what we need to be for the world. Because I don't think this culture is going to shift, and peace is not going to come, and people aren't going to learn how to talk to each other if we can't model it for them, if we can't be the go-between, if we can't stand in the gap. Aristotle said that where your talent intersects with the need of the world, there lies your vocation. The need of the world is great, because we're in a totally stagnant place, and peace is not possible in so many places. Even in our own community, people are arguing about so many things, and people have forgotten how to speak to each other with empathy and compassion. It's a problem. The talent of the church is that we're the people that know we stand deeply in need of grace, and we are humble about it. And it reminds us that everyone stands in need of grace. We are the people of empathy. We are the people of compassion. And so it seems that with that talent and with the world's need, I think we really know where lies our vocation.